From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
I dug in behind the podium like a young Jackie Robinson. I leaned into the mic, gripping my first poem, a short piece about Negroes being afraid of the revolution. The words left my mouth and were smacked across the room with applause. Wow, a single in my first at-bat. The evening was young, and I was young. I stepped off base after the first poem and thought about stealing second and perhaps making writing my career.
Ethelbert Miller is known as the Dean of D.C. Poets. A longtime literary activist and former head of Howard University's African American Resource Center has important perspectives to share on the state of cultural, social, and academic opportunities for people of color in our nation. And I'm looking forward to starting our Black History Month observance with Dr. Miller on this week's State of Belief Radio. Even as the important work of governance resumes in Washington, even as real signs of progress finally emerge in overcoming the deadly pandemic that has ravaged America for a year now, even as some of the inhumane policies of the previous administration are mercifully reversed, incredible damage has been done to the fabric of our society and to the role of religion as a force of public good. As I've said before on this show, God has been given a bad name. And it's important, no, it's essential, to identify where the corruption of the language and moral authority of faith came from, and to devise strategies to defend it from future misuse. To those who discourage finger-pointing, I say, if only the culpable were to stand up and admit that their single-minded partisan prostitution of religion helped inflame passions that led to great risk to our constitutional democracy, to grave threats to the lives of elected leaders of both parties, and to the death of brave law enforcement officers in defending both, well, then we could come together to look for peaceful solutions together. But as long as those who were the most effective in fomenting hate, fear, and division in the name of God pretend to be innocent bystanders puzzling at how Antifa atheists managed to get a hold of all of those crosses and MAGA hats, well, pointing fingers is a patriotic duty. Thankfully, in the aftermath of this disastrous year in general, and January 6th in particular, responsible writers and analysts have connected important dots to identify the theocratic anti-democracy impulses at the heart of these disasters. A major Rolling Stone report by investigative journalist Sarah Posner, How the Christian Right Helped Foment Insurrection, goes a long way toward exposing the inevitability of what we saw happen. And a recent Religion Dispatches commentary from Chrissy Stroop, Stop Trying to Save Jesus. Fundamentalism reinforces the problem of Christian supremacism, delves into the more sociological aspects of this ongoing threat to our diverse secular democracy. You'll hear from both of these writers later in the hour. This year, State of Belief Radio is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcasts from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible thanks to you. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. E. Ethelbert Miller is a literary activist and author of two memoirs and several poetry collections. A keen observer of the human condition, Dr. Miller is the perfect guest to launch our Black History Month coverage with. Ethelbert, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
A lot has been written in the past couple of years about supposedly raised consciousness of inequalities and systemic racism in this country. But for someone who has spent a lifetime among students and other young African Americans, that kind of headline in 2020 has got to be beyond maddening, doesn't it?
Well, you know, what happened when we look at social movements, there's a sort of ebb and flow. So if we look at last year, that just doesn't occur out of nowhere. You know, one could go back to like the Occupy movement. You could go back and say things began with the women's movement, the Me Too movement. And so what you see happening over in our society are various movements taking place, and it's constant. You know, it's just like a wave. And sometimes what happens is that it's the ebb and flow. And what happens is that what we saw in the last 4 years is things coming to a peak. And that's where we are right now. And how we resolve that is going to be the challenge that we face going ahead.
What are the ways that cultural dominance being threatened has expressed itself in the reassertion of privilege?
Well, I think what happens, we live in a time of social media. We live in a time in which language has been, I would say, corrupted. You know, we have words that or slogans that can become harmful that we don't think through. And that's the other thing that I think is really affecting how we exist as a society. I like to think of the fact that our level of decency has declined. It might sound a little old-fashioned, but, you know, as soon as you stop spelling words correctly, as soon as you start, like, twittering and trying to condense language, I think there's going to be some implications of how it affects our society. You know, there has to be guidelines, you know, and I'll give you an example. In social media, if you post something, say, on Facebook, you know, all of a sudden you say, okay, how many likes did I get? Well, yeah, you can get a lot of likes. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean it's good.
Okay. Right.
The same way, for example, you can see the danger that we have. And I'm a baseball person. We've gotten into analytics. We got into numbers. So when you turn on the TV, let's just say the CNN, and you see in that right side these numbers of COVID, well, then you can ask yourself, at what point when they stop posting those numbers or those numbers begin to go down, at what point will we return to being to a sense of being normalcy, you know? Mm-hmm. Is it all based on numbers? You see? Mm-hmm. The same way, for example, we see a lot of society in conflict, and some of it is the fact that it's a battle of narratives. Okay, if I mm-hmm. watch Fox News, that's one narrative. If I watch MSNBC, that's another narrative. Okay? And what I find is the problem is sometimes the same things are not being covered. Mm-hmm. Okay? You know, not that it has a slant, but something is just not getting covered. And so some people just, oh, I didn't know about that. You know, and that's how it is when we think about Black History Month, you know, this month now. You present certain things to white people and say, oh, I never heard of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. I never heard of Juneteenth. And they don't know. And they're good people. They just don't know. And that mm-hmm. was not part of their narrative. And then what happens is time. If I try to find time for your narrative, then I may have to cut out something of mine. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's just like if you're a teacher. And you say, okay, I want to introduce more things about women, more things about indigenous people. What are you going to take out? You only have a certain amount of time. And that's the battle where we are right now in terms of sharing power and sharing decision-making.
Mm. I'm sure you would expect me to ask this question, and it is an important one for our listeners. How significant do you think the religious component of this has been?
Well, religion is key. You know, I strongly believe in what Lewis and King always talked about, and that was the beloved community. You know, we go back to Martin Luther King, the book that came out after his death, you know, where do we go from here? Chaos of community. The community that he's talking about is not the black community, but the beloved community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the challenge. I feel that if we have leaders that don't have a moral compass, that's going to be a problem. If we have teachers who teach us facts and figures, but not ethics, we're going to have a problem. You know, I always raise a question, and this was a number of years ago when I was at Howard University. I was always concerned about whether if a student was in a school of business, would he or she take an ethics course? Okay, because I've been around on university campuses, and because like many institutions, they go through financial crisis and they have to cut things. And so what happens? You'll be sitting in these rooms, and what are they going to cut? They're going to cut the philosophy department. Why? Because they're looking at numbers. Oh, there's not. We only graduate three graduate students in philosophy. Let's get rid of that. Okay. And what happens? Not realizing that here is the importance of the humanities. Okay, that you can't have people becoming scientists and engineers and doctors and lawyers unless they have access to understanding the key questions, which are spiritual questions. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Who are we? Why am I here? Okay, mm-hmm. I think that if you don't have a spiritual base, then you can work for the oil companies. You can destroy nature because you have a certain view of like, okay, the market comes first. That's your mm-hmm. ethics. Those are your values.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so if you don't have a spiritual base, you can't go far. And then what we have to look at is even if you have a spiritual base, if it's been corroded at the bottom, okay, where all of a sudden what happens, you've gotten away from the basic fundamental teachings of, say, Christianity or Judaism or Islam, then that's going to be a problem. Because where you have those little cracks in the foundation, that's where sometimes the nationalism comes in. It fills a little space where all of a sudden you think that your faith is the faith.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's my thing is what I see happening today, in terms of this moral or spiritual presence hardening mm-hmm. to such a point that it's becoming like more Old Testament than New Testament.
Hmm. Not very successfully, but I guess we've gotten used to looking at the representation of minorities in popular culture as one barometer of inclusivity. I wish you would talk about what, if any, progress America academia, literally publishing and fine arts, have made on this score, if any.
Well, you know, when you deal with culture, when you deal with images, when you deal with things like film, paintings, illustrations in magazines, that's where we see the change. Some people would say that when the first, I think it might be Marsh McLuhan, when the first black person, you know, was on TV who could enter like a white person's bedroom on a TV set, that's when integration became a problem. Mm. Okay. What happens is that for many times, minorities are invisible. Okay. You know, Native Americans are invisible. You know, black people are invisible, you know. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that this is why many times those groups have to work in terms of restoring images or building images that might seem angry or defiant. But what happens, they have to make sure that they're being seen. You know, what happens is what we see now is this colorization of America. America is no longer just a white country. It's no longer a white and black country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is why, you know, years ago we talked about this Rainbow Coalition. And that Rainbow Coalition, you know, represents how people express themselves culturally,
mm-hmm.
whether it's through their songs, mm-hmm. through their paintings, through their literature. And what happens, that's where you have to say, okay, we can produce this work, but do we share it? Do we understand it? Look at what just happened at Biden's inauguration. People saw Amanda Gorman, you know. Wow, she's a young black poet.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. Well, she's a young black poet, but the young people, almost her same age, years ago were changing the South. She's no younger than say, a young Julian Bond, you know, mm-hmm. John Lewis. She's no younger than that. But what happens, we're seeing her for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened? We saw her dress and we saw her age. You know, those are the two things that we focus on. And so what happens is that, yes, you can have this representation, or is it not seen and then understood, then it means nothing.
Mm. What are the areas of greatest concern for you today as the country seems poised to sink once again into a kind of self-congratulatory denial of the systemic problems that so universally exist?
Well, I think, you know, I was just reading something yesterday, which was a breakdown of the people who attacked the Capitol. And what we find out is that when you really break down who the people are, where are they from, you realize a lot of people are not, we're not from the red states, you know. A lot of people were not unemployed, you know, that all of a sudden you have like professionals, you know, you had people who pretty much, you know, existed in a blue Biden part of the country. But what happens is that they found out, I guess, felt that their views were not being heard, that, you know, there was too much a sense of other people taking gains at their expense. And that can be a problem. But every time you see like a black person getting promoted, you feel, okay, that's a position I could have had.
Mm-hmm.
Or if, for example, there's an emphasis on issues of race, then you feel, okay, I'm white and they're not talking about me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And that is where we are right now. How we resolve those things takes leadership, and it really takes the fact that we have to make sure that we acknowledge the mistakes that we've made.
Mm.
You know, we've made a lot of mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Ethelbert, I am fortunate to have published a number of books. You are the author of several, in addition to writing the poetry that has earned you that honorific, the Dean of DC Poets. What's the role for this kind of publishing in today's Twitter speed, short attention span culture?
Well, what happens, you have to instruct people, and this gets into like parenting, you have to instruct people to do the heavy lifting. You know, it's not going to all be carry out, you know, quick and go. It's not all going to be buffet. You know, you're going to have to learn how to set a table, you know. And so what happens is that's where the rigor. You know, I look at, for example, people talk about sports. I'll take someone like Steph Curry on the Warriors. They say, well, look at how he's shooting these threes, and it's almost automatic. Yes, because he practices. You know, and that's what happens. It's not any sort of athletic ability. He's like not really bigger than many of us. But what happens, it's a skill, just like a musician. He has to practice, okay? Mm-hmm. If you want to be a good writer, you have to practice. And what happens? It means you have to pay attention to craft, structure, punctuation, okay? So you've got a lot of people, you know, okay, they're you know, changing the words, the spelling, things like that. That's good if you can spell. Okay, if you think this is phonetic, that's how you hear it, and that's how you spell it. Well, what happens, and that has a lot to do with social media too. You can get away with anything, and there's no critic, there's no one to tell you that you're doing the wrong thing. You know, you can see happening in terms of we are have a generation that's almost giving up on parenting. Put your child in front of a terminal, you know, a computer screen. You know, and I'll go do what I have to do. Mm-hmm. Well, how many of us are going to put our phones down to pay attention to terms of learning how to read critically? Okay, read critically.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us don't read critically. Or what happens, we skim. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or what happens, you have contests where, okay, I'll give you a T-shirt and a mug if you read a book. Well, there's no bribing in terms of that. You either have to learn how to be taught the enjoyment of literature, and you have to be taught the difficult. I remember I was being a workshop, and there was a woman in this workshop, white woman, who went into like the public schools in Baltimore, and she did this. She was teaching like Ezra Pound. You know? And somebody said, well, you're teaching Ezra Pound to these black kids? Yeah, I'm going to teach Ezra Pound because I know after they read and master Ezra Pound, if I give them a Langston Hughes poem, they're going to understand it very quickly. You know? And what happened, she believed in her students. She believed that they could master the very difficult things, you know. And that's something that, you know, that's how we have to teach. We can't say, for example, that youth is always right. There's a role for elders to correct youth when they make mistakes, you know. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that this is a way in which if we're going to move ahead, we're going to have to say, okay, let's get back to fundamentals.
Yeah.
Let's get back to fundamentals.
Ethelbert, as you watch the clumsy way our society has struggled with indicting truths and ugly realities, are you hopeful about the future of this nation? And separately, is there one important consideration that you see being ignored in the earnest but often simplistic conversations that we're hearing around race and justice in 2021?
Well, you know what happens? If being an artist, you have to be hopeful, even if you paint pictures of despair. You know, even if you write books that, or you sing the blues, you have to be hopeful. That's what you do. You know, I feel that as an artist, my job is to sort of like explore the wilderness, you know, to prepare for what could come. You know, I want to see the possibilities. That I think is key. But then in terms of what the challenge is, it's very simple. And people like Baldwin writes about it. We're caught up in a lover's struggle in a society. And if you look at that battle, the struggle, if you ask yourself, it is very difficult loving one person, okay? there's a lot of bad marriages out there. There's a lot of relationships that are not making. And what happens? It's work. And if you don't want to put the work in, then you don't know what love is, okay? You know, and that's the challenge, okay? You know, I'm not even saying love thy neighbor. I'm just talking about first loving yourself, okay? Within many minority communities, there's a certain degree of self-hatred. I could be Asian and hate my eyes. I could be, you know, Latino and I hate my color. That has to be corrected, okay? That's why we have Black History Month with Carter G. Woodson, to make sure that if a black person looks into a mirror, okay, they're going to be positive. They're going to love themselves. But what happens after you look in the mirror and love yourself, you can't be narcissistic. You have to say, okay, let me turn and now look out the window and see the world and love the world too. Okay? Yeah. And I am realizing that when I go out there trying to love somebody, there's going to be disappointment. If there was no disappointment, there would be no blues. and the essence, the blues is survival music. The blues is saying, yes, your house is gone, your woman left you, but you're going to have to get out there, get up out of bed, and deal with whatever's coming tomorrow. Okay? And that's what we have to think in terms of America. What we see people running through the tunnel with the Confederate flag, what's coming next? And I tell you, what I saw yesterday, you know, where here you have Green being applauded, you know, by the Republicans, and I wrote a thing. I said, oh, this is Green, and now here comes the Browning of America. Because what happened, you know, this is like somebody like Hitler, you know, playing a club in a cafe in Germany somewhere, you know, Austria. And what happened, what's coming? You see, and what is coming is because we weren't silent. The same way we can see that because Donald Trump questioned Obama's birth certificate, he became president. That's how he got started. Now, this woman doesn't want to believe in 9/11 and the Parkland shooting. What's going to happen to her? And I can see this woman, okay, all due respect to Nikki Haley, she could be running against Kamala Harris, two women running against each other. But then the green person can emerge. And what you can see, and this gets back to this conversation, it's nothing but branding and hustling. And this is where you realize there are people with no moral fiber, no profiles in courage. You know, thank God for Cheney standing up for principles, you know, and this is what has opened the door, okay? So everything we're trying to do as artists is to correct this and make sure that this narrative is not co-opted, okay? You know, we've had over the last few years the best chance and opportunity for all of us to finally understand what's in our Constitution, okay?
Yes.
And this is the catch. What we don't accept is that there's two constitutions, okay? Not the first one, you know, that everybody wants to cite, you know, the Scalia. No, it's the second one, the one that emerges after the Civil War, the one with all those little amendments, okay? That's the second one, okay? That's the one if you're gay or you're disability. Yeah, all those things in there where you're expanding it, okay? That's where the Constitution begins. Okay, and it begins at the same time that we've had a civil war, so we had to start over again and get it right. You see, and what happens is that the same way people want to put up Confederate monuments after, you know, Reconstruction, to push especially black people back onto the plantation, make them sharecroppers or something. You see right now in 2021, trying to take those monuments down because there's a movement, okay, that has to fulfill the promise that we had at this, after the First Civil War. We can't go through that again. Okay? And this is the thing, that if we don't have a moral compass, like say like someone like Lincoln, you can't get through this. If you cannot stand up on principle, you know, this is what John Kennedy, and a principle. You mean to tell me that you are going to be in a party and support somebody that doesn't believe in 9/11, you know, the Jews have some sort of laser, you are going to stand with that? I don't know how you can go home and love your family. I don't understand that. And this is a challenge where right now, what we saw happening yesterday, for me as an artist, I have to be hopeful that, like in Jonestown, that the grilled cheese sandwiches and Kool-Aids are not being handed out.
We're going to have to get together again and help answer the question that, that
the
you
Kool-Aid.
Just asked. Yes. E. Ethelbert Miller is a literary activist and author of two memoirs and several poetry collections. He hosts the WPFW morning radio show On the Margin and the Scholars of UDC TV, which received a 2020 Telly Award. His latest book, If God Invented Baseball, was awarded the 2019 Literary Award for Poetry by the Black Caucus of the American Library Association. Dr. Miller, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I hope we can stay in touch. May many blessings.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Brace yourself for two compelling takes on the origins and ongoing threat of American Christian nationalism. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. The Rolling Stone report is headlined, How the Christian Right Helped Foment Insurrection. Think that's provocative? Here's the subhead. Christian right activists inside and outside of government promoted the election fraud lie and claimed God told them to let the church roar. I think we've all seen an encouraging amount of coverage at long last of the pivotal role the theocratic political right has played in legitimizing the outrageous anti-democratic impulses we've all watched play out in our nation's capital. But there were so many warning signs that got ignored leading up to January 6th. Few journalists have the depth of knowledge needed to contextualize these disasters like Sarah Posner, who has tirelessly chronicled the sinister players in the worlds of church and state for decades. So it's a good thing that the Rolling Stone article bears her byline, and it's a very good thing that she is back with us again this week. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. I'm glad to be back with you, but not so glad about the circumstances.
Oh, isn't that the truth? You meticulously make your way through some of the most egregious acts and offenses we endured from the Trump administration, and you remind us how religiously, pun intended, the theocratic right defended and even amplified those acts over and over and over again. So let's start with some examples of that echo chamber.
Well, throughout Trump's presidency, his Christian right and Christian nationalist loyalists supported him no matter what he did that might have led somebody on the outside to believe, how is this a Christian act or how is this a moral act that the president has committed? And they defended him because he was engaged in the same anti-democratic small d project that they were. And this became abundantly apparent in the run-up to January 6th because he had the greatest support in his Stop the Steal election fraud lie from the Christian right. They repeated his lies. They repeated his conspiracy theories. They claimed, you know, they supported legislators who tried to stop the process of counting the votes or tabulating the votes or certifying the election or certifying the Electoral College. And then on January 6th, we saw a lot of Christian rhetoric and iconography and Bibles and praying in the name of Jesus, crosses, Jesus save signs throughout the insurrection. Mm-hmm. And when I did a kind of reconstruction of what happened in the run-up to that in the days and weeks after the election through January 6th, I found that the Christian right was very involved in mobilizing activists to engage in Stop This, Participate and Stop the Steal rallies and protests, that they partnered with the Stop the Steal organization and featured speakers at rallies who later participated in the siege. And they did this under the auspices of purporting to mimic Joshua's army that brought down the walls of Jericho in the Bible, and that this Joshua's army, this Jericho March, as they called it, was organized by two people who worked for the Trump administration at the Department of Health and Human Services. So I don't know if there's a short way of saying it other than it came from the inside.
Yeah. Where do you see the results of this being most entrenched today? Where is the religious right more Trumpy than Trump himself now that he's gone from the White House?
Well, I think that they are still, they're persisting in the idea that the election was stolen. They're persisting in the idea that elections, any election won by a Democrat was stolen or fraudulent. There's been a lot of chatter about how could Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff have won those Senate races in Georgia, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that the upcoming second impeachment trial of Trump is going to bring him back to the center of the political conversation and bring him back to the center of the Christian rights persecution narratives. Mm-hmm. It'll be the new witch hunt hoax thing for them. Mm-hmm. You know, that mm-hmm. their anointed leader was not only wrongfully deprived of his office, but also that he's now being persecuted by his Democratic enemies. Mm-hmm. For something that they believe he did not do. They don't believe that he incited anything. And second of all, they've been fomenting the conspiracy theory that it wasn't actually Trump supporters who invaded the Capitol, but rather Antifa or Black Lives Matter protesters who were posing as Trump supporters in order to malign them.
Sarah, let's look back for a moment. How much of the political zealotry of our time can be traced back to earlier political religious right extremism, like Operation Rescue, where advocating for a cause evolved into a murderous hatred of opponents? To me, this level of dehumanization parallels some of the worst wartime scenarios of modern history, and I find that profoundly troubling.
Well, I think that there's a lot of different facets of the American right that came together on January 6th, some by design and some just by circumstance. And, you know, the anti-abortion movement is one of them. I mean, there's been reporting on people who were at the Capitol who also had experience protesting outside abortion clinics. And we know that a lot of that has turned violent by, like you say, the demonization of the enemy, the perceived justification for murdering a doctor who performs abortions under the perceived claim that, you know, that's going to save babies. I think that there's been a lot of demonization of liberal Christians. There's been a lot of demonization of liberals, and you mix that up with a lot of end times theology and the idea of spiritual warfare that's pounded into the heads of a lot of evangelicals and Pentecostals, that they need to be engaged in spiritual warfare against demonic enemies. And I think this whole cauldron creates a situation where some people, not all people who hear it, can be incited to violence.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, what is the lasting damage that will outlive our thoughts about the administration that can be blamed on the demands of the theocratic enablers?
Well, I think the lasting damage is their assault on reality and the truth. They claim that they believe in the truth of what they say is in the Bible, God's infallible word. But they have been the most significant participant and promoter of Donald Trump's attack on the truth and attack on reality. So they've twisted many of the things that have happened over the course of Trump's presidency into something else, such as, you know, promoting the conspiracy theory that the Russia investigation was a hoax, mm-hmm. or that the first impeachment of Trump was a witch hunt. And now they're already, in the moments after the siege, they were already promoting the conspiracy theory that it wasn't actually MAGA people who participated in it, even though Trump held a rally and told his followers to march to the Capitol and fight like hell. Mm-hmm. Then they're trying to create this alternative reality whereby that wasn't them, and it was really just Antifa or Black Lives Matter protesters who were trying to make Trump look bad. Mm. These kinds of revisionist history, conspiracy theories, whatever you want to call them, have captivated a good chunk of the American population and specifically of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And that's why we see people like Marjorie Taylor Greene gaining this enormous foothold in the party apparatus in the House of Representatives.
Yeah. I don't see any kind of regret, any kind of coming to one's senses on the part of the kind of theocrats that you write about. So is it hyperbolic to say that maybe when we look way back and see what was happening then with the religious right and then what we are now seeing of the religious right, it may be more dangerous now than it's ever been?
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, I do think that there are people who are willing to commit acts of violence in the name of Jesus or in the name of God. And, you know, that's a subset, right? Like that's a smaller number, but the larger number is very willing to believe conspiracy theories and is essentially living in an alternative reality. Mm. And the damage to democracy and to civil society caused by that, caused by the, you know, the claim that there was some kind of attempt by Trump's enemies to commit these acts of violence, to pin it falsely on Trump supporters. You know, as we've seen throughout history, these kinds of lies are extremely dangerous. They form the underpinning for support for fascist regimes. And I think we're at a very critical juncture in that regard.
Mm. I worry when the current administration is endlessly libeled as being anti-God. This is more of the kind of crusade rhetoric that brought us to January the 6th. Do you see President Biden being directly in danger?
Well, I mean, hopefully the Secret Service will keep him safe. But I think it's very dangerous, the kind of sort of us and them, good versus evil, God versus Satan rhetoric that is being deployed by the Christian right and has, you know, has been deployed for decades. But I think now it's at this moment where for 4 years they promoted the idea that Trump was God's anointed leader. And now they've pivoted to God's anointed leader had the election stolen from him. And he has been replaced by this fake Christian who might be a secret communist or socialist or something. This is very dangerous, hot rhetoric that, like I said, can incite people to violence, but even without actual physical violence, is like a violent act upon our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, I urge all of our listeners to take in your excellent article in its entirety. But before we wrap up our conversation, what else do you want to highlight from this piece and the reporting that you did in preparation for writing it?
There was this event on December 12th called the Jericho March, and it featured a lot of religious right leaders and political leaders, people like Mike Flynn, Trump's disgraced national security advisor, Eric Metaxas, the popular author and radio host, Alex Jones, the conspiracist, you know, just this lineup of evangelical and far-right Catholic speakers who spoke in very, you know, violent terms about the election being stolen and what Christians needed to do and that the deep state was against them and they were going to be like Joshua's army and bring down the walls of Jericho. And at the time, it got a little bit of coverage in real time, but it was mostly coverage that was like, wow, look how wacky these people are who think that they're going to like encircle Washington like Joshua's army encircled Jericho. Just sort of focusing on the weird attempt at this analogy. And then when you look at it in hindsight, sometimes in hindsight, things make a little bit more sense or come into view a little bit more clearly. And I think it shows you just how seriously a lot of people take those kinds of analogies, and also just how much a lot of Christian right leadership are willing to make alliances with these far right groups in support of Trump, people like Alex Jones, people like Stuart Rhodes, who was one of the founders of the Oath Keepers, spoke at that event. Ali Alexander, who was the leader of the Stop the Steal movement. So, you know, if the insurrection hadn't happened, this event would probably never really be specifically remembered, the Jericho March on December 12th. But when you look at it in hindsight, it looks, you know, right. It correctly looks quite ominous.
Sarah, what should every American of goodwill be doing right now to ensure that we don't see a resurgent political religious right reemerge even more powerful and destructive?
Well, I think it's very important for people to vote, for people to think about supporting candidates well before elections, to support organizations that organize voters and get voters registered to vote, and sort of building up that kind of infrastructure. What we saw happen in Georgia, for example, where that kind of organizing helped not only elect Joe Biden, but elect Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, despite anti-Semitic, racist, and false attacks on them. It's really a tribute to the organizers in Georgia and what a fantastic job they did. And so all is not lost. You know, if a state like Georgia, you know, can turn blue and, you know, defeat that kind of racist Christianist attacks on people, candidates like Ossoff and Warnock, then, you know, these are the sorts of, that's the sort of work that's worth investing in to save our democracy.
Sarah Posner is an award-winning investigative journalist and the author of two essential books on the American religious right, most recently of Unholy, Why White Evangelical Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. A sought-after commentator and analyst, Sarah is a reporting fellow at Type Investigations. Her recent Rolling Stone article is titled "Capital Riot, How the Christian Right Helped Foment Insurrection," and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Thank you again for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, it's always absolutely my honor and privilege, Welton.
Over the years, Chrissy Stroup has appeared on this program in connection with her work leading the ex-evangelical movement, encouraging escape from toxic religion, analyzing theocratic impulses undermining our democracy, a full plate for anybody. But Chrissy's recent writing for Religion Dispatches has been particularly timely and incisive, bringing a deep understanding of the themes flowing through our struggling civilization and how they play out in grandiose ways. Dr. Stroup's recent piece, headlined "Stop Trying to Save Jesus: Fundamentalism Reinforces the Problem of Christian Supremacism," compelled us to have her back with us again. It's always good to have you with us. Chrissy, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words about my work and the article and for extending the invitation, Milton. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
The piece is headlined, "Stop Trying to Save Jesus." Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I guess the idea came from the sense that I often find myself arguing online with people that I might call toxic fans of Jesus, you know, who just get very, very defensive the minute that you start criticizing anything related to systemic Christian hegemony and the ways that it allows things like Christian nationalism to show up at the Capitol and as a motivating force for the invaders. And the invaders, of course, you know, were just let right through by some of the Capitol police. They also killed some of the Capitol police. You know, there are things that we need to look at, like why are so many evangelical churches in the United States centers of resistance to sensible public health measures, to mask wearing and so forth, and conspiracy theories. And if everyone wants to just come along and say, but okay, but they're not following the teachings of Jesus, I feel like that's kind of a deflection. Mm-hmm. And it's also indicative of maybe an internal debate, but ultimately, when you have these different Christian communities who understand Christian values and teachings in very different ways, I think it's not helpful to, for the general public to kind of decide, well, okay, those people are the real Christians and those people are not. I think that actually sort of serves to uphold Christian hegemony in our society and to undermine pluralism.
So, Chrissy, who is this Jesus that the Jericho marchers, the Capitol invaders, the self-righteous haters serve?
Well, I'm going to borrow the title of a podcast that I cited in my article, and I would say that that Jesus is straight white American Jesus. Mm-hmm. Of course, that Jesus is not the historical Jesus, and that Jesus is not the Jesus of social justice Christians. And yet, that particular Jesus you know, is an interpretation of him that is very powerful in our society and in many parts of the world, something like this hyper-masculine Jesus who was recently explored in Kristen Covas-Dumais' brilliant book, Jesus and John Wayne. That's the Jesus that we're looking at here, the kind of Jesus who, you know, maybe we would relate to him more through the book of Revelation or the more sort of apocalyptic passages. in Matthew, Jesus with a sword coming out of his mouth to smite his enemies. The Jesus is a sort of ultimate divine retribution. And, of course, the enemies of God here are defined as Democrats and people who oppose Donald Trump. And then in some cases, even Republicans. I mean, some of these folks were ready to hang Mike Pence because he didn't agree with Trump's bizarre theory that he could somehow wave a magic wand and stop Congress from certifying Joe Biden's victory in the election.
Yeah. Talk about what you mean by fundamentalism.
Sure. Well, I didn't coin the term. A pop culture commentator named Emily Vanderwerf did. And what she means by that is that there are groups of fans in pop culture areas like comic books and TV shows, or we could also talk about books, podcasts, commentators, and so forth, movies. And when we talk about a toxic fandom, which exhibits characteristics of fundamentalism, what is meant by that is that these fans exhibit a kind of religious zealotry, a kind of extremism that starts to look like fundamentalist religion in their defense of what is called in slang their fave, right? Mm-hmm. Or their favorite thing or celebrity or whatever. So, for example, if you want to take the usually the white male fans of the old Ghostbusters movie, the original, or the original Star Wars trilogy, a lot of those folks have reacted very badly to sequels and remakes that center female and non-white characters. They feel like they're somehow losing something there, which doesn't make sense to me, because why can't we just sort of expand and share and everyone can have fun, you know, with the ideas and the universes and the worlds that these movies built. But no, they sort of feel like they're losing something, like it's destroying their childhood nostalgia for the films that they loved if we take those franchises in a different direction that doesn't put straight white male characters at the very center of it. And what Emily kind of posited about them, and I think it's a very astute observation, is that these folks are trying, you know, they're not only just enjoying these movies as a fan, but they're somehow deriving some kind of meaning from them. But obviously this is not a kind of healthy meaning or democratic meaning. And she argues that this is really too much pressure to put on a pop culture phenomenon in the first place. But of course, deriving meaning and helping us navigate our values through that and in community is what it's a primary function of what religion does. And I noticed that in this fandom literature where people write about pop culture, they're often using terms that we use in religious studies like in-group and out-group consciousness to describe how fans behave. And then I thought, what if we flip that script and we take the pop culture analysis lens and we put it on believers and sometimes how they treat the people or divinities that they venerate. And so I started thinking of defensive Christians as Jesus fans, or in the, you know, young people slang, Jesus stands. And then they behave very much like the fans of, say, the old Ghostbusters movie behave, or the fans of atheist podcaster Sam Harris, who has been railing against so-called social justice warriors and has been promoting Charles Murray's sort of new race science and doing some very racist things. Every time you criticize Sam Harris on Twitter, you get a whole bunch of people in your replies telling you that Sam Harris is not racist and Sam Harris is great and why are you so mean to Sam Harris? And the same thing happens with Jesus. And so I thought, well, you know, let's look at that phenomenon and then let's also maybe ask people to consider, does Jesus, who is supposed to be their savior, really need them to save him? And, you know, I was also thinking about theology, and I think it was, I don't know if he came up with this distinction, but it was through Marcus Borg that I encountered the idea of the historical Jesus versus the Jesus of faith. Mm-hmm. And even if we believe the historical Jesus, you know, was a healer and a radical who was committed to justice for different groups of people, you know, that's still distinct from the Jesus of faith. Mm-hmm. And if you kind of take that one step further, I thought, well, you know, different Christian communities clearly have different Jesuses of faith. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe some are closer to the historical Jesus than others. Certainly, I think so. I find you know, the kind of Jesus that I see that you believe in, Belton, much more congenial than, you know, straight white American Jesus, and they do think he's closer to the historical Jesus. But if we want to look at the whole phenomenon from the perspectives of religious studies or pop culture studies, we can see that these other Jesuses have a lot of cultural weight and power, and we need to address that and how it can be systemic in a society where, you know, we do have Christian supremacy in the sense that in much of the media, it's still very taboo to criticize any large Christian group, and where Christian holidays are still elevated above the holidays of other religions and so forth. You know, there are a lot of ways, and we often don't even really think about it, that Christianity still defines our lives in America. And I think we get distracted from maybe addressing that and talking about how we could be more democratic, more pluralist, by getting sort of bogged down in debates about, well, who is Jesus? Those debates have value among Christians and in theology. But when we look at things from a social or historical or cultural perspective, we see that straight white American Jesus is something that comes out of Christianity and also American culture. But I think you can trace a line back from straight white American Jesus to, you know, Christos Pantocrator, who was, you know, the big symbol of the Byzantine Empire, and all the way back to Constantine. There has been this strand in Christianity where Jesus has been used to uphold worldly power. And we might think that the historical Jesus would reject that, and I do, but I also think that in many discussions, that's kind of beside the point. I guess that's what I was trying to get at in that article.
Yeah. Is that part of why serving this kind of Redeemer comes so naturally for these people?
Yeah, I suppose so. I think that, you know, when religion works well and when people become part of a healthy religious community, then it really is about decentering their own desires, right? But the great temptation in a religion is to find ways to use it to justify the fulfillment of your own desires. And the worshipers of straight white American Jesus, well, they want their idealized imaginary 1950s America back, where white Christians were very much on top of the social hierarchy, and that was pretty much unchallenged. So when religion goes unhealthy, when religion goes fundamentalist, that's what you have, right? People using religion for their own power, for their own gain. You can say that that runs counter to the message of the historical Jesus, and I think that for the most part it does. But again, their Jesus has been a part of Christianity since at least the 4th century, some version of that Jesus.
You know, Chrissy, January the 6th didn't come to be just out of nowhere. Would you describe some of the steps that got us there, especially in terms of Christian nationalist rhetoric and some of the warnings that we should have seen?
Sure, Belton. So with respect to that Christian nationalist rhetoric, I think what a lot of the general public doesn't know is that in Christian schools and often in homeschooling, there are these fundamentalist curricula that are used put out by companies like Abeka and Bob Jones, and there are some others like ACE, Accelerated Christian Education, or Bill Gothard, some Institute for Basic Life Principles. Well, I guess he's not there anymore because of, you know, the whole sexual harassment scandals and everything. But, you know, a lot of people were raised on IBLP or ACE or Abeka or Bob Jones. And the textbooks, there's actually been some really good studies done that really dug into this and got some data. The Huffington Post in 2017 published a great expose, really backed up by data and serious research, on the kinds of things that Abeka and Bob Jones teach, and on how many schools there might be in the country that not only use those books, but also use public funding from vouchers to teach them. And they came up with the number roughly 2,400, and there are definitely more that don't take voucher funding but do use those books. And then homeschooling, it's just hard to get the data. Mm-hmm. But there's been a whole generation of people raised by what has become the vast majority of white evangelicals on Christian nationalist rhetoric, where the textbooks teach things like they refer to slavery as black immigration. They talk about how the black Africans in South Africa never would have been able to build a decent society without those white colonizers, and they basically support apartheid. They teach us that Jesus wants us basically to take control of the government to impose Christian values, that, you know, basically everything exists either in rebellion against God as understood by them, or under God's authority, and we need to bring government and everything else under God's authority according to the biblical worldview or the Christian worldview. That's the language that they use. In these schools, children say the pledge to the American flag, and then the Christian flag, and then the Bible every morning. And we saw those Christian flags flying at the Capitol insurrection. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's an interesting point, right? You know, these are the same people who fought to add under God to the Pledge of Allegiance in the 1950s, so that was relatively uncontroversial at the time for most Americans because of the Cold War context and wanting to fight godless communism with belief in God. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you then combine that with the pledge to the Christian flag, which ends with Jesus bringing life and liberty, not for all, but for all who believe, you're fusing God and country, and you're really attacking the very concept of pluralism, at least understood as, you know, a situation in which everyone deserves equal accommodation in the public square. These textbooks are often explicitly anti-democratic. They focus a lot on how America was founded as a republic. They teach false ideas. Well, first of all, the distinction between a democracy and a republic is something that they kind of made up because it works for them to try to defend undemocratic sort of situations that we have with, for example, the Electoral College and, mm-hmm. and representation in Congress. You know, they'll talk about mob rule being the alternative, and I think there's, you know, that's not the only alternative. But yeah, they also want to paint all the founding fathers basically as Christians like they are, and that's really a huge distortion of what the founding fathers were really like. I mean, George Washington, you know, he after he was the president and everything, he attended some church services, but he would never take communion because he didn't really believe it. He thought that, you know, maybe a lot of the common people need religion in order to be good, but that, you know, besides the moral message, there's a whole lot of just nonsense that people believe. And that's what Washington mm-hmm. thought. You know, Thomas Jefferson was even more kind of explicitly anti-Christian than Washington was. And he, of course, famously made his own Bible by cutting out all the things that he didn't believe and just leaving some of the words of Jesus there that he thought were wise. Mm-hmm. So they distort history like that. And, yeah. and we saw that same version of history in this so-called 1776 report mm-hmm. that the Trump administration put out just before Biden's inauguration.
Do you think we as a culture have learned anything of substance from this episode, or are we still too much in the middle, or heaven help us, are we just at the beginning of it?
I fear that we haven't learned enough. I hope that maybe we've started to learn something. But, you know, I do think that January 6th, if we don't take it seriously, could become our beer hall putsch. You know, 1923, Germany, the beginning of the rise of Nazism, rather than, you know, the end of something like that, some kind of American fascism. We have to hold people accountable for what happened. I don't see that we're really taking steps to do that yet. I mean, a great step and something that could show a sign of good faith from the Republican Party would be if they actually not only allowed the second impeachment of Trump to take place, but they convicted him of incitement to insurrection and barred him from holding public office in the future. But I don't think they'll do that. Mm-hmm. Right now, Republicans in power seem to be trying to just get us to forget that whole January 6th thing ever happened, and certainly not to point fingers at them, even though clearly the connections are there. But when you kick things under the rug like that, they tend to come back and bite you, you know?
A prominent ex-evangelical writer, speaker, and advocate, Chrissy Stroup, is co-editor of the essay anthology Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church. And we'll link to her article, Stop Trying to Save Jesus, Fundamentalism Reinforces the Problem of Christian Supremacism, from stateofbelief.com. Chrissy, thank you so much for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Anytime, Weldon. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.